Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge, and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed, except for this book. I'm not doing the review as soon as I finish reading it. Instead, I've waited around about a month since finishing off, because joining me this time around once more is my girlfriend Juliana. Say hi to everyone, Juliana.
Hello.
And we're going to talk about the Arthur C. Clarke novel Rendezvous. That's really weird, because I was looking at the German cover, because you read it in German, and I got completely confused in my head. Rendezvous with Rama, and in German it is called
Rendezvous mit 31439.
Yeah, which Rendezvous is with 31439. Yeah. And the reason for that, well, we mentioned this before in a previous podcast. The reason it's called that is because in Germany, Rama is a kind of margarine spread. Yeah. So I guess yes. Well, so they didn't want to call it Rendezvous with Flora or Rendezvous with, you know. So what do you call the Hindu god Rama? Is it Hindu god?
Rama.
That's Rama, yeah. As well. But it's got different connotations. But yeah, so it's a bit strange why they didn't just call it Rama. But
it's a very clunky title.
Yeah. So I read this book years and years and years and years ago. Probably one of the, you know, it's like when you first getting into science fiction, people go, oh, okay, a list of good science fiction authors or big science fiction authors. You know, what's it going to be? Which are the top books that you want to read? And of course, people's names, you know, especially back in the, I guess, 90s when I was starting to get more into science fiction. Of course, the different names have come up all the time. And Arthur C. Clarke's name would always come up. And people point out this book as one of his best novels or one of his most representative novels. Have you read other Arthur C. Clarke?
Me?
Yeah.
Don't think so.
I don't think so.
What did I read? No,
2001. Let me bring up his list here. So we've got, Child's End, City in the Stars. Did you read The City in the Stars? No, you didn't, did you?
No.
Oh, yeah, I reviewed that one. So I have done a few other of these books. Fountains of Paradise is good. 2001 Space Odyssey, Rendezvous with Rama. I think these are his best known novels, if you know what I mean. So he wrote loads of short stories and was a scientist. He was a radar guy as well, radar technician in the Second World War. So he was a technician and scientist of his own in his own right. And in the same way that Isaac Asimov had his ideas of stuff, you know, so you'd read one of his stories and it's all about, and then the engineers save the day, you know, really do they? Yes, they make a new spaceship or they make a new spacesuit and all this different kind of thing. You get these different ideas that are going on there. Or you get that in quite a lot of his novels. You just read, what was the one that you just read? The Stranger in a Strange Land? That was Heinlein as well. Yeah, Heinlein. And Heinlein is too. Yeah, Heinlein, Arthur C. Clarke and Isaac Asimov. It's all like, yes, and then science. And, you know, kind of, it's kind of the real, what do you say, like the clearest examples of science fiction, because it's not just fiction, it's not just science fiction, not just speculative fiction, but it's about scientists going somewhere and exploring something and solving a problem, or technicians doing something. It's very much about scientists coming out and winning the day.
Very much about humans.
Well, yeah, human science and stuff. Yeah, yeah.
But it also, like, in every of these books, it's also a bit about religion.
Yeah, yeah. They always throw that kind of stuff in.
Always. Now, all these books, like, especially in The Strange in a Strange Land.
Oh, yeah. I don't want to get into that.
No,
You really didn't like it, did you?
I did like it, but the
first part.
End was just, oh.
I think I've told the story of my reading experience of Stranger in a Strange Land years and years ago. I read most of it, and in the printing of the book that I had, the last like 10 pages or something were missing. They just weren't included in the book. It just got to the point, like one sentence was halfway through and then it was just at the back cover of the book, and I was like, oh, not really. But by that point I was really disliking the end so much, and I never went back and read that last bit
again.
I totally
understand it. And it was very disappointing for me as well.
Because I was talking to you about it, and I was saying, "Why has he got to? You know, is he in the fairground yet?" I can't remember what you're saying. And then I was saying, "Yeah, and he's in all the Jesus stuff." And you're like, "What Jesus stuff?" And I was like, "Oh, yeah, just
just keep on reading."
Yeah, just keep reading. Mm. Anyway, so let's get back to Arthur C. Clarke. So, Rendezvous with Rama, one of his best known books. We haven't really discussed how we're going to do this review. I was just going to go through the standard format of what I do. You know, talk a bit about the reason I read this book. One of the main reasons I read this book was because, because lots of people were asking, "Hey, you should read, you know, you should do Founders of Paradise or Rendezvous with Rama or something like that." And then We were looking at a page where we were looking at, what was it, the spaceship sizes page. I should look up on here.
That's very helpful.
Yeah, there's a really good website called Spaceship Size. Let me just Google it here. Spaceship Size, sizes. Jeff Russell's Starship Dimensions, merzo.net, merzo.net, and it's Starship Dimensions, and they've just got the sizes of all of these, all loads of different starships that are mentioned in books. Mostly it's television series like Star Trek and all that kind of thing. And
so I can see a Borg cube.
Yes, on the front website here, there's the Borg cube, there's like the Enterprise, a Millennium Falcon, you know, the Star Destroyers from Star Wars, all these different kind of things. And were we just looking at this website? I can't remember what we were even looking at it for now. Watching Firefly. And we were like, how big is the Firefly thing? So we got through that, and then we looked at this, and I said, oh, and look, there's Rama, and it's just this black square. And you're like, well, what's that? Yes. And it's like, well, it's 50 kilometers long, and it's 20 kilometers across, but in the end, it just comes off as a big black square. Oh, is it on the this one here? Is it in the?
And still,
I can't see it.
Even after reading the book,
yeah, it's still just a big.
Especially while reading that book,
yeah,
it is very difficult to build up a picture of.
We will talk about that. Here
it is.
Yeah, that's the whale probe. No, here it is, Rama. We're getting mixed up over the whale probe from Star Trek 4. And here we go, Rama. 50 kilometers long, 20 kilometers in diameter. And you're like, well, what's this? So anyway, we decided to check out this book. And that was one of the reasons I thought, I'll just read it again. I was inspired to read this book again. There it is.
And let me just say, I because I have an iPad and I like reading e-books. We mentioned that before, right?
Yeah.
And getting... science fiction ebooks in German, it's always a bit of a difficult thing.
So where did you get it this time?
Well, I just like typed it in and searched for it, and there was a forum, and somebody uploaded a PDF, and I just downloaded this PDF, and
well, there you go. You would pay for it if there was possible to pay for it. Yeah,
definitely pay if there would be more than Perry Rhodan in German science fiction.
Sections, yes. So, just starting off, what did you think about the German translation? You think it was a good translation? You know, you understood what was going on with the German translation?
Yeah, it was good. It wasn't like terrible sentences or words that didn't make sense and stuff. It was good.
Really good.
Really good to read. The sentences were like really...
Yeah.
Easy to read. And
but there was one of those things. I remember you read a book once and it was called $1 billion. That was the German translated title. The title of there was called $1 billion, and it was about the guy whose ancestors, like 20 generations ago invested money, and now like nobody realized that like half of the world's money was in this one bank account, and then he got the money out of the bank account, and it was like, oh yes, I've got $1 billion. And it was in German. Yeah.
1 billion is worth, in English...
A trillion.
Yes.
Yeah, so he'd got $1 trillion, but it was only up in like that very last, like, it was like in the appendix, wasn't it? It's like, oh, yes, and if you're talking about this to your English friends, don't say that he had $1 billion, say that he had $1 trillion, and you're like,
And it makes more sense to the English-speaking people, because then it's more impressive.
Yeah, of course, you don't want to say, oh, yeah, and he got $1 billion, because, it's just a translation. I just thought I'd bring that up, because that's a funny little story on different translation issues and stuff. Anyway, I just want to start off this. I listened to this on an audiobook, and I just want to complain massively about the audiobook. Normally I do these Audible ads where I tell people to go to audibletrial.com/SFBRP and get down a free trial. And you can do that. Definitely go there and get a free trial. Do not get this audiobook. This is literally one of the worst narrated audiobooks I've ever had. And I'm not going to say this lightly, but Wil Wheaton in Red Shirts was actually a better narrator than this guy. First of all, his accents were pretty bad. One of the main characters in this book is Australian, and his Australian accent was bad. But I can, as long as you understand what's going on. But it was just crazy, crazy making that. Like, all the time he would talk, there would be pauses, but not where he would be wanting to know what came next. But it's like every time you reached the end of a line, he would then pause for a while. And I've got my iPhone here, so I'll just play it in. I'm not quite sure where the microphone is on this laptop.
Interested in objects smaller than galaxies, and never bothered to conceal his prejudices. And though he had to admit that 90% of his science was now based upon observations from space-borne instruments.
Don't pause between it was now from. From is never a point of the sentence where you pause. Anyway, it just goes on and on like this. And even worse, or actually, I'd not say even worse, but the audiobook starts off.
Writer myself.
And it starts off, and suddenly it goes, maybe I can hear
this,
it. Oh, no, I can't find it. But it goes, this is audible, blah, 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 blah. And then it goes, and now a foreword by Robert J. Sawyer. And Robert's like, hi, my name's Robert J. Sawyer. And I'm like, skip, fuck off, Robert J. Sawyer. Oh, man, I can't believe, oh, I'm really making this, I'm talking too loud here. But yeah, if any audiobook starts with, hi, my name's Robert J. Sawyer, it goes down a lot in my estimation. So this book is actually one of the worst books that I've ever heard narrated. You see there, I said, I've ever heard. I could have stopped there, but then there was another bit going on. So it was all the time that you're always thinking, was that the last word in the sentence that he was talking? Oh man, it's just terrible. Anyway, so do not go to audibletrial.com and get, you know,
Solaris.
Yeah, get Solaris. I mentioned that in a previous podcast. There is actually an ebook version of the English, direct English translation of Solaris.
Amazon.
On Amazon, you can get the Kindle version of that. So, I'm just going to turn this down a bit because I think I'm distorting the audio a bit here by talking too loudly, but yeah. I'm not sure. Anyway, let's move on to this book. So the world of this book is it's set a few hundred years in the future, or mostly, and it starts off with a space guard.
Not really 100 years.
No, this is the, but then it skips forward after the space guard is set up. So okay. An asteroid or a comet comes in, smacks into the Earth, and when does it smack into the Earth on?
The 11th of September.
Yeah, September 11th is that one of these world-changing...
2077.
Yeah. So a world-changing thing. And that's something that we both made a note of. It was like, oh, September the 11th. Of course, you're going to pick any date. It's going to be... You could be picking any date, you know.
Something has happened.
Something has happened on that day. Like, yeah. Even in Berlin, you've got, you know, you've got the 9th of November is the time, you know, it was sort of like the end of the... No, Christi-
everything was...
Yeah, it was like Kristallnacht was then, the Berlin Wall fell, yeah.
And this is actually that, like, they would have picked the 9th of November to be...
Yeah, the reunification day.
Day, but because so many other... bad things happen on that day. The Germans celebrate their national day on the 3rd of October.
Yeah, that was...
This is the only reason.
Yeah. And no after the First World War, there was all this like, yes, now we're Germany, we're now the Weimar Republic, and down the other end of Berlin are like, no, we're a communist state, both on the same day. And that was, again, 9th of November. So it was a funny little thing there. So anyway, what happens is Summit smacks into, is it Italy? Italy is wiped out by a comet.
Yeah.
And then they're like, hey, let's keep an eye out for these things in the future.
Which I find quite funny that he took Italy, like North Italy, like he destroyed Arthur C. Clarke.
Yeah.
Decided to have Venice destroyed and Padua and Verona.
Why not?
Why? I mean, why these cities? Because... They're like...
But
where is he from?
Well, at that point, he was probably living in Sri Lanka, off the south of India.
Okay, then it doesn't and really matter. England...
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's not like it's, oh, I'm really racist against those Italians. You know, it's not like, it's just like, oh, let's just pick somewhere, you know. I mean, but he could have just gone, oh, and it hit Siberia. But comets coming
Nobody
down and
cares,
meteorites hitting Siberia. Well, people do care because it makes for really fun YouTube videos these days. But like, if it really wipes something out, like there's lots of places on Earth which you could hit and people go... a meteorite hitting North Dakota and people go, oh, well, you know, that kind of messes up, Mount Rushmore and that's about it. Oh, is that South Dakota? I don't know. But you know what I mean? It's like, you got to hit old world. You got to hit old civilization and stuff like that. Wipe some of them off. Anyway, so it hits that. So then skip forward a few hundred years and you're like, hey, let's keep an eye out for this stuff coming in. And then something comes in. And it looks like, well, you're not really quite sure what it looks like. Anyway.
But they first notice it because after this catastrophe, they installed this
Space Guard. Yeah, maybe I didn't explain what that was.
Which is like something we actually do have, right?
Really.
Don't we have some satellites spying out for asteroids?
The thing is, the Space Guard, these were like way out also. They weren't just around Earth. They were actually like, spread around the solar system to keep track of things coming
further
in.
Away.
Yeah, further in. So it's not just like, what can we see from Earth before something hits into Earth? Because like... like in that case, you would be in the worst possible place. Like if you're at the target, like you don't want to, like if someone shoots a gun at you and the bullet's going to take time to hit you, you don't want to be at the target and find out about it once you can see it from the target. You want to be, you want to find out about it when it's like on its way or even when it starts off.
So
I think that the idea of Space Guard was that it was also set around, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
So, and then skip forward a few hundred years and, yeah, I think that I think it's actually. Oh yeah, so yeah, skip forward. Yeah, you found the date. Skip forward to the year 2130, and humans are spread out throughout the solar system. And it's an interesting setup because, like, there's lots of people left on Earth, of course, and the moon is really important too because that's where most other people are. And then Mars is a little bit less important because there's fewer people there. And then Mercury is even less important, and they've got like a different thing because they all have to live underground. And then you've got people from the asteroid belt, and then people from Saturn and Jupiter, and all these people spread out. And of course, it's difficult to communicate through it throughout the solar system. A lot of the novel is talking about like people sending messages and having conferences and then updating people and coming back and forth. Oh, it's going to take 20 minutes for the signal to get from here to Earth, and it's going to take 8 minutes to, you know, to get back across this place. And so a lot of it's especially in the very end of it, it's like, oh, I mean, I'm not going to give away what happens near the very end. It's like, yes, but if we set off now, they won't find out about it for another 8 minutes. And you're like, well, why is it 8 minutes? It's the speed of light. The speed of light gives us 8 minutes. Yeah.
What I really like at the beginning is the idea of colonizing. What's the word?
Colonizing.
Colonizing other planets in our solar system.
Yeah.
This is really
it's a standard for science fiction. Yeah. But what I like about it, he doesn't, because nothing's set on a planet, he doesn't talk about it. It's like, and now here's how they terraformed Mars, and this is what they're doing here.
It's a fact.
It's just a fact. But I like about it is he's just going, and this guy has got a wife on Mars and he's got a wife on the moon. And you're like, really? And you think, well, this is just a small thing, but it's played so well throughout the book. Like, I mean, it's one of the few human touches. I mean, there are a few fun human stories in this one.
Yes.
But generally it's just like, oh, and he's got a wife here and a wife there. And because not many people are actually astronauts, not many people travel between planets.
Yeah.
He's one of the few people who can have wives on different places. Yeah, and it just seems.
And also it's difficult. But like he says, his families never can meet because of the different gravity.
Yes.
Weight. Like the wife on the moon, she was born on moon, I think.
Yeah, so she can never go to Earth.
She could never go to Earth because the gravity would like push her together.
But yeah, but she could go to Mars or so. I can't remember what it was, but there was a place where they could both meet.
Like he really thinks about it, and it's like a really clever thing where he's like, oh no, yeah, they actually can't meet because of the fact that they were born there.
And I really like it. A lot of if there's a few passages where he's going, this is what was the commander's name again?
Norton.
Yeah, Commander Norton. He's like, and because he's always doing like he's sending messages, but he doesn't want to send one message to one wife and then one message to the other one.
Very practical.
Yeah, but it's not just that, because it's also favoritism. He doesn't want to be keeping secrets. It's sort of like, oh, here. Oh, didn't I tell you about that? Oh, I must have told my other wife. He didn't want to do that. So he wants to keep the communication as much as possible equal between the two. Yeah. But then he'll say blah, blah, blah. And then he'll say, oh, does he know? Does she ever meet the second in command, or did she ever meet Laura?
I just leave it out.
Like, yeah, like, or let me go back and edit that one. Oh, and I'll just leave it. Like, I'll record most. I'll make like two introductions, and then the main body of the message will be the same. And then at the end, I'll change the end for one, and then change the end for the other. You know, but he gets distracted and is like, oh shit, which is it? Oh fuck, okay, it's taking too long. I can't think about it. I've got to investigate this alien civilization.
I just send a message which is like just like a very neutral.
Yeah, it's like,
just,
hey, I'll get back to you soon. I might be dead by then. Yeah,
or maybe not.
Yeah, we don't know. So yeah, just the idea that the humans are spread out throughout the solar system. Again, what I like about this book is that we see this world through the eyes of someone who travels around a lot, and through about like, well, okay, where's the capital city? Like, where's the capital of the solar system? When it turns out the moon, oh, but it can't be on Earth, because then the Earth would be too important. But then it takes too long for people to get from, you know, was it like Uranus or Neptune? Is it Neptune? Some people come in from Neptune. I can't even remember. But there's
no Jupiter, Mars, Earth, Venus, and Mercury.
Yeah, I think. I think there's there's
oh, other people on.
Yeah, I think there's people that are going out like trans Neptunians or whatever they are. Anyway, so
Neptunians.
I don't know. So that's the setup. Spaceships are flying around. Commander Norton is the commander of one of these ships. He's a pretty, you know, decent guy. He knows what he's doing. He's got scientists on board. He's got some other passengers on board. And they're going out and they're investigating comets and other stuff. So it's their job to keep track. They're part of the Space Guard as well, I think. But they're going off on a thing. And then Space Guard goes, hey, there's something coming in. And it's not, and it's very dark. Yeah, because it's all black, isn't it? And they work out, oh, but there's a slight, it's spinning. Oh, but why is it spinning? It's very regular spinning. Otherwise, it's very regular. And then, of course, this thing's coming in, coming in at a speed. And is it slowing down? I can't remember, but maybe I was just, maybe I'm just remembering that.
Yeah,
from,
yeah, it is slowing down. And they calculate that it's going towards the sun.
Yeah,
and
it's going to slingshot around the sun, isn't it? Yeah. So they're like, okay, let's go out and meet it. And so pretty much that's like the setup for the novel. And they go out and meet it. And it's called Rama because, you know, you've got to give these things names.
Which is not 31,
48,
400,
yeah. Yeah, you've got to make it a bit better than that. What else did I have in here as well? We were talking a bit. I know we mentioned on the Solaris that the spaceship that goes out to drop him off is called the Prometheus, and then there was the other. We saw,
this
also
one
watched
is
Prometheus.
Called Endeavour.
Yes, but they actually talk about this a bit more. It's not just like Endeavour. They said because they mentioned this a few times as well. It's like, well, Endeavour was it Cook's ship or was it Cook?
Yes.
Yeah.
Cook.
And so yes, Endeavour was his ship, and he went off around the world and stuff like that. And yeah, it's good in that way that they do take a journey of exploration in that way. What else have I got here? Yeah, a little bit like Prometheus. Laura Ernst. Yeah, there was a character called Laura Ernst, and I know a juggler called Laura Ernst. And again, it's just a maybe it's
is
just
she is she the medis the doctor
Laura Ernst.
Laura.
Yeah, Laura Ernst. She's
Laura
a doctor or doctor scientist or something like that. She becomes one of the main female characters because it almost feels as though Arthur C. Clarke was writing the book and he's like, oh, well, we haven't had any female characters do anything heroic or interesting yet.
Yeah.
But then he also like has a like almost a conversation between the characters saying, well, we haven't had any, well, it's good that we have to have someone in charge, and the reason that we haven't done this, had this person in charge, is, but you know, and they kind of like rectify it, and in the end she does become one of the major figures. She comes like second in command or something like that, I think, by the end of
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
She directs a lot of the research. So anyway, they get to Rama and they attach the spaceship to this spinning object and then go in and explore. And the rest of the book is them exploring it. And again, it's like difficult to say what the spoilers are going to be by the end of it. Like, what are they going to find? We're not going to say exactly what they're going to find, but it's a lot about like, well, what's here? What can we find? This is obviously artificial, but who made it? And like, it's come so long between the stars that anything on board, they would have died by now. You know, there's no way to get
and
through.
Also they figure out that it's like very, very old. They say like they traveled through space, like, 100,000 years or something, like very long. And they also figured out, well, if all of these, like, if there's some living things on it, they couldn't just survive by putting themselves into like a sleep.
Because even the atoms of their, or the molecules or the cells of their body would break down no matter,
yes,
like just so, by quantum fluctuations over that time frame or whatever.
And then
it is.
They had to figure out, oh, so when we dock on here, what are these, like, what is, what for?
Yeah, what is this for?
What is this for in general? Like, they attach to this big black,
Spinning thing,
and then they explore it, and they find things, and they have to...
But let's talk a little bit about what they found, because you were a bit confused by this. First of all, you were going, well, where's the sea? Like, how does the sea stay there? You were asking me, like, what's going on with the sea? So what did you have in your brain when they first encountered it? You knew that it was 50 kilometers long and 20 kilometers wide.
Which is
then,
already, like, really difficult to...
Yeah,
like,
to get your head around. Yeah. There's a great line in the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Douglas Adams, and they go out and he says, and he went into this big cavern and he knew what infinity felt like. He says, but infinity, knowing what infinity feels like, you can't actually look at infinity and know what it feels like because it's just black. It just goes on, you know, it's too big. You can't get your head around it. So the only way that you can actually understand what infinity feels like is to see something which isn't quite infinite, but you can kind of just see the edge of it.
Yeah.
And you really get that kind of feeling.
And this
feeling.
Is very well explained, like, from the point of view from the commander.
Yeah.
Because he has this feeling like they get out of the ship and then they kind of
go through it, yeah.
Walk down some steps.
Yeah, you're not quite sure how long it's going to be. Yeah.
And then you think, well, where did they attach to? Was it on the outside? And how did they get on the inside? And then
they go through the door, and there's a spinning thing, and they're at the hub, you know, the axis that's spinning. Yeah, I understand it's a bit confusing. So we had a few conversations, and then I went onto Google image search and typed in Rendezvous with Rama or Rama Inside of Rama and hit go. And it's actually quite an interesting collection of images because you get so many different. You know, from the different covers of the books and different magazine articles, and there's a short movie made of it.
To make the a picture of it because it really is difficult to understand by reading the book how it looks like.
Well, I think if you're more into science fiction or if you've read a lot more science fiction, you can just go like a centrifuge habitat. So you know it's going to be spinning and you know you're going to be going inside of it. Look, there's even like a blueprint of it here as well. Look, it's there. And when you go down the steps at the end, you come in this end and you go down the steps and then there's the sea in the middle.
That looks way more like I thought about it. Not so much like with...
But that's like a cross-section that you're seeing there.
Clouds and blue sky.
Well, the clouds and blue sky, this is not Rama. You know, this is more Rama or whatever it is. It's not about the clouds and blue sky. That's, you know, that's the classical thing that you go in and it's in space, but there's trees in space and it's all like paradise in space. This
but
is not paradise.
Rama.
No, not on Rama. They go in and it's just pitch black and they go, well, fuck, we can't see. What are we looking
at here? Then they have these three like whatever these three lines.
No, there's actually six of them. I don't know why all of these have three, but I'm pretty sure there's six. Yeah, again, I don't want to give away too much what they're going, but it's dark, and then there's some light sources, and there's when it comes out, and this whole big thing is absolutely massive, and on the inside. What's that? Yeah, that's what it looks like.
This one looks pretty good. Yeah. This is a.
So it looks from the outside, you see.
Yeah.
But you were confused about like how does the water stay where the water is.
Yeah, I mean, I did understand that obviously the spinning made the water like attached to the edges.
Yeah.
But then I thought, well, how?
Well, how does it stay in and this? Yeah.
And then how can it spin around and then they are on this ship and like this all just like super difficult to imagine. It is so against my natural.
I think the point is that it's so against everybody's natural thing. Like your screensaver is going on there and you can see these African plains of these National Geographic things coming up. That's what humans are meant to look at. We're meant to look at flat plains with trees and sun in the sky and clouds in the sky. That's what we're evolved to do. And the whole point of this book is to go not just like, hey, aliens are different, but it goes like aliens are so different that what we want, like things that we have in our brains, we're going to attach them to other things. You know, like you say, oh, and then there's the city and they call one of the city, was it New York, London
yeah,
and
New
Paris?
York, yes.
And they're like, well, they're not really cities. They're just collections of geometric shapes. But the only thing that they have in their head, collections of geometric shapes, cities.
It is similar where like when you tell a child a word that child has never heard before.
Yeah.
But it has heard other words which sound similar.
Yeah.
The child takes the word that it heard and connects it to the word that sounds similar. It already knows the word. And then it just puts it together and say, oh, and just like puts a funny mix and say, oh, this word means that.
Yeah.
Because it is something they already know and they have in their head and they think, this is what they heard.
Yeah.
And this is like when you see something where you think, oh, this looks like that. You just immediately like put like New York.
Yeah.
But it
keeps backfiring on them. And every time they think of something, it's like, oh, well, this is this. And this is this. And there's a big trench. Well, what's a trench for? Well, what are trenches used for? And because they're all thinking a trench is used for keeping something in.
Mm.
But it's difficult. Like But what if you're looking at a trench from underneath? Or what if you're looking at a trench across the other side of the cylinder? Like what you think something is used for on the flat plains of Africa or in a city. When you actually get to another thing where geometry is curved around on itself and gravity doesn't exist in the same way, and all these kind of things. And that's what you get another time. One of my favourite scenes in this. Of course, like I say, most of the rest of the book is them exploring it. There's other action stuff that going on there. But the way that they explore it, I actually really like, because it's the opposite of, say, the movie Prometheus, where it's like, hey, let's just go in, guys, and do this. So, of course, they do have a similar scene where they're like, oh, maybe we can breathe this atmosphere. You know, they're like, oh, that's lucky.
But before they take their helmets off.
Yeah, they spend a long time.
like, analysing all the air and all that stuff. And also, Commander Norton is a character, and it says very clearly at the beginning that he is not somebody like taking risks so easy.
Yeah.
So, He said at the beginning he's not going to risk any of his crew.
Yeah.
If something happens, well, he just collects them and just leave.
Yeah.
And it's
pretty impressive that how many, again, it's one of those things that you don't really want to give it away, but it's so great to see a story like this, which, like, it isn't about, and then the monster comes out and kills one of them, and then the next one, and by the end of it, there's only one survivor. I mean, of course, accidents do happen, you know, some people are hurt and things, but all the way through, it's in this alien situation, and then using the human ingenuity, the human science, the human technology, and it's actually going, no, the way we will do it, it's like the opposite of all horror movies ever. It's like, oh, I'll go over here, guys, I'll meet you back at this point. It's like, okay, wait here, don't run upstairs, you know, all these different rules that you don't. It's always like, okay, we have this many people, they need this much rest, they can get this way, we can shine a light on them down from above. Nobody ever goes out unless they're with someone who's already been out, you know, these different rules, all these different formulations.
It's really clever. Like, if something happens like that, take this as an example how secure you can act in a situation like that. Because it's really, like, it's when they have this light shining down and they always have the connection to the people that are out.
Like line of sight connection with everyone. They have to keep looking at everyone. And one person's job is just to sit at the top and just look at everyone and make sure that the normal, typical, like, you know, space exploration horror stuff doesn't happen. You know, like every movie, all movies, well, not all of them, but so many of these movies are based around, right, someone's got to wear the idiot hat. They're going to do something really stupid and wrong.
Yeah.
And then that's going to set off the drama for everything else. Like, or there's going to be a monster come out and people are going to react like idiots. And they do, and then that's it. And again, I don't want to bring it back to Prometheus again, but oh, it's just the worst thing ever. And I don't want people to act like idiots, you know. And sometimes it can work. If you set people up as idiots, like if you set, like in say, in the movie Aliens, they go into this thing and they're like, and Ripley's like, what? Are those armor-piercing rounds? Yeah, they are. Well, there's a nuclear reactor down there. It's like, okay, everybody give me all of your ammunition. Nobody's allowed to use any firearms. And everyone's like, what the fuck? You know, just the whole situation. So the people who use the firearms weren't doing something stupid, but they were acting with incomplete information because the commander didn't say, if you use firearms down there, this nuclear reactor is going to blow. And of course, that's what happens later on. It sets up the end of the movie. You need that to drive the story forward. But in this, there's never anything like, the commander never goes, do this. And they're like, why? It's like, it's not important. Just follow my instructions. I'll tell you later. It's always like, okay, everybody, here is everything that you need to know. These are all of the rules. Everybody knows. Everybody can make intelligent decisions all the time.
Also, the Commander Norton is a guy, like, where the crew can come to him and if they have any idea about what's going on Rama and what could it be and stuff, because nobody knows.
Yeah.
Everybody can come to him and say, hey, I have this idea. Can I talk to you about it? And there are two people coming to him and having different opinions about what Rama, what is Rama's purpose and stuff.
And the best way to and get this, around it safely,
and,
yeah.
And also, like, the second one where he has a conversation with somebody is actually really helpful for the story and for for the better discoverage and, like, for... Discovery of Rama.
Yeah.
So he's also not only a commander who likes to say, everybody does what I do, what I want, what I say. He's, like, really open for suggestions. Yeah. Like, really, for me, this was like a really sympathetic character.
Yeah, he is a good character, even though he doesn't even have much to do. But like, you get to know him through his family and about his communication like that, and it's quite interesting. Like, he, for someone who is just so like, who would be just so boring. Like, if the, you know, we were just looking before about, you know, Morgan Freeman, who's wanting to make a movie of this. I was trying to get this movie. Of this done, made for ages. And of course it's really difficult because you're going, like, it's amazing, yeah, it's all about discovery and aliens and it's about these capable people going in and discovering stuff, and you're like, yeah, but what's the main conflict? And it's like, the main conflict is man against his own ignorance and trying to find his place in the world. No, but like, where does, you know, when does the spaceship blow up, and you know, and how, where's the big escape at the end? And you're like, yeah, well, I guess there is a little bit at the end, and you know, it's like even Arthur C. Clarke realizes, okay, we've got to have some kind of drama at the end, yeah. And there is drama, but that's not enough to sustain. Like, to go through a movie, you have to have, like,
they would have to put way more on top.
Well, you'd have to go, okay, you're going to investigate Rama, and then, I mean, it would be a bit more like Ringworld by Larry Niven. You've not read that, but again, they go there to investigate this thing, and then the ship crashes, and then they've got to get off it. That's right, the beginning of the book. But the idea is that the main thing comes is like, you don't land on the ship well, you crash on the ship, and now you've got to get off. You know, it's when we watch Pitch Black, it's the same thing.
The
ship
crashes. Several times.
Yeah, it happens, yeah. That kind of thing, and that's the kind of thing you would need. It's like, meanwhile, they're stuck on this thing and they're discovering stuff, but monsters, but spaceship crashes, but there's a psychopathic killer that's coming along with them. You know, yet all these things time and time again, yeah, in science fiction. Rendezvous with Rama doesn't have any of that. It's like, sensible people go and they don't crash their ship. They don't do stupid stuff. They follow instructions. They've got a whole team of people, experts back on Earth. Oh yeah, I'll talk about that in a minute. And giving them advice and getting them out of trouble by using science and knowledge and cleverness.
And they just really act like you would think people would act. Like, whenever there's a situation coming up, like in Prometheus, and like, you see two women running away from something that falls down, and they run just straight. Like, why don't you just like go right or left or?
But the worst thing is that one of them rolls, like, she falls over and then rolls sideways and escapes it. So you're like, all you had to do is run
one step
in a slightly different direction at the speed that somebody can literally lay down and roll.
Yeah. Okay, I don't want to talk about Prometheus. It's a bad movie. But like, every decision that's made in Rendezvous with Rama is like made with brain. And
this is why I think this book, and again, it comes back to this, this is why I think this book is so popular among, like, science fiction nerds and geeks, because, and I've talked about this before on the podcast, is that we, as nerds, as geeks, as people who like science and like technology and like all these different kind of things, we like to think that the world, what actually gets us by in the world, is science and technology and following the rules and following this. And it's like, well, if everyone just did this, everything would go like that. And unfortunately, if you actually read the journeys of discovery of these things, like, just following the rules didn't get you. Magellan, which was the first guy to sail, you know, to sail around, you know, across the Pacific in the other direction, you know, and all that kind of stuff, he died halfway through. Why? Because he had guns, and the tribe that he landed at in this island, the Polynesian tribe, didn't have guns, and he was like, oh, we'll help you out, we'll make you king, and did that, and then got dead, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, and Cook himself was like, oh, Lenny, oh, well, he was fucked up, and, you know, all this other kind of stuff. And you go, like, the history of the Bounty. I went to Pitcairn Island a few months ago, and it's just like, yeah, and these guys, they tried to sail around one way around, but it didn't work, and they went back again. No matter how much they'd, you know, got right and followed all the rules, so many of these discoveries, or the Bounty wasn't a great journey of discovery, but yeah, if we bring it back to Cook, it's like, yeah, and in the end, yeah, he was stabbed to death on the shore of an island in Hawaii.
So many of these great people in history, they were just like, when you read about their deaths, it was
it's just like, idiot fell down a hill.
Yeah, he stabbed himself in his foot or whatever, or he swallowed something and died.
Yeah, but it's not just about that. It's about actually the way that the discovery is made as well. Of course, nowadays science, it can be forwarded like that way, but when you're talking about discovery, like, Christopher Columbus sails across and he finds gold, and he's like, yeah, gold, and then, you know, he exploits all the, you know, all the Native Americans and, you know, and these different islands or wherever he landed, and you actually read the story, it's just like, this was not you know, there where was the, like, yay science, yay discovery, yay technology? And what we have in science fiction now is that we can actually stack the deck for the nerds. We can stack the deck for the geeks and the rule followers and the science-y kind of people. So many of these science fiction books are, like, if it was in a situation where what they found in Rama was actually more dangerous, this crew, it wouldn't have gone okay for them. It wouldn't have worked out, and maybe they would have needed the Marines from Aliens in there to shake things up a bit.
Like, what is a really good example for this behavior is that when something kind of goes unexpected, I don't know how much I can say about it, but, like, let me put it this way.
What happens?
They had to go back to their ship.
Yeah.
And actually they thought about they had to leave their supplies and stuff down there because it was no way that they could take all the stuff back to the ship.
Yeah, they were worried. It's like, well, should we take this with us? Is it irresponsible for us to take it?
Yeah. Like, how would these, like, aliens behave if they would found our rubbish there?
Yeah.
And like, it's
like, what would they think of Earth if they just turned up and it's like, guys, these people have been shitting over here. Oh, man, there's a pile of shit. Oh, they could have just... Look, we don't want to clean up after these damn humans. Yeah, it's exactly that
and
kind of thing.
They care. This crew, they care, like, especially Commander Norton. He cares about all these things. And then when the incident happens, and then they come back to the surface, and then they collect all their stuff together again.
Yeah.
And which I find, like, just this tiny bit of thinking,
like,
about
don't
something.
Drop any litter. We never know what's going to happen with it.
Like, don't like leave it so as untouched as possible.
Yeah.
I mean, they can't really because they're there and they in the end, like, they do more things on Rama. Yeah. But just this tiny bit of thinking about how to behave like when you are somewhere with a stranger.
It's always like, it's always appealing to our highest aspirations, our highest morals and ethics. It's like, and that's what this science fiction does so well. It's like, you know, when you watch Wall-E, you're like, yeah, nobody should drop litter. We should save more and all of that kind of stuff. And you should exercise and not, you know, all these kind of things. It's just appealing. It's like, yes, we want to be good. And the thing is, in Wall-E, the only way that they can actually have a character who is that virtuous is to have him a robot who doesn't speak and that literally can't do anything wrong. And then it's just one of those things that I think with Rama, the reason why a book with, I wouldn't say no action, because there is quite a bit of action, but like no big central conflict. It's like, what's it a book about? Oh, these guys go and explore somewhere, and you're like, is that it? No, that's not it. They explore somewhere in a way that appeals to the best parts of humanity. And as geeks and nerds, that's what we really want to see. And with Morgan Freeman, who's obviously a science fiction fan, is like, yeah, let's do this and let's do that. And then all the other Hollywood executives are looking at it and going, yeah, we need like about 8 more explosions. Probably some really dangerous monsters and
some people dying.
And probably about 1 or 2 psychopath, sociopath kind of characters in the crew for some reason, for no reason at all, maybe, but you know.
The only person which I wanted to talk about to you, I don't know if it's a spoiler, but there's this ambassador from Mercury.
Oh yeah, let's talk a bit about the stuff that goes on outside of this. I just want to mention something. I really enjoy the guy who takes his glider, who does the glider trip is one of the highlights of the book for me.
This is he came up with the idea and then he came to Commander Norton and said, hey, I have this, I can't do that. Can I do it?
Yeah, but also the great thing is about getting him back again. Like, he goes all the way there and then getting him back again is this massive group effort, which is... It's one of these, but it's not a group effort just of him. They're getting messages from people back on Earth. They've got scientists working the problem, and in the end, how they actually get him back across the sea, I think, is really good. I don't want to give it away, but it's one of those things that you just, oh, that's really clever. Yeah, so they have these people going back again, and you've got the Space Advisory Council, and this is a council that the people on Rama didn't even know existed. It's just like these group of there's the Science Council, and then there's the other one as well. Is it? Yeah, all the ones with all the scientists get together. Yeah, they've got scientists from here and scientists from there and scientists from
and
here.
The most important guy is the Petraeus. Petraeus. Yeah. So he's a very important scientist. Like.
Yeah.
His ideas are some major ideas for the discovery of Rama.
Yeah.
Which I don't want to.
You don't want to spoil too much. Yeah. anyway, so yeah, you do have these other factions going on, like you say, you've got these different people, but then you've got this religious faction, which is like a kind of religion based around, hey, aliens are going to turn up one day. We've got to be ready for them, or do people think they're ready? I can't remember the exact details of this thing. But one of the people on board the spaceship, or a few of them on board the spaceship.
One is this Boris Rodrigo.
Yeah, Boris Rodrigo is a member of this weird kind of religion cult thing as well. And again, you're thinking, oh no, it's going to be there. You know, people aren't, you know, this is going to turn out badly for this kind of thing. But yeah, it's interesting the way that kind of plays in, and he can talk about religion, but kind of a relevant religion. He doesn't just go, well, what would Christians think if aliens turned up? It's like, yeah, but that's been done so many other times. It's like, and what would, you know, Muslims, or what would Buddhists, what would all these other religions, or what would atheists think when aliens turned up? He actually takes it, you know, in a different direction, and kind of creates a religion and talks about religion in that way. He talks about faith and religion and how much your belief influences what you do.
There's this little bit of the Bible coming up as well.
What's the Bible? Which bit in the Bible?
This is the bit you're going to find it.
The
Cosmo Christ.
Oh yeah, the Cosmo. That's what I say. This
Cosmo Christ.
Yeah, that was the name of the cult. Cosmo Christians.
Cosmic Christians, or however it's called in English. Yeah. I just have the German ebook here.
And I've got an audio book, so it's difficult for me to skim through and find what I was wanting.
And he wants to send a message to the Mother Church, this Boris guy.
Yeah. So you got a bit of going on there. But also what I really like is this Science Advisory Council. Now, one thing I didn't like about this is that sometimes you'd be going on and they'd be like, action, exploring, spaceship, yeah. And suddenly it'd be like, wait, history lesson, and you're like, no, get back to Rama. But then you actually realize how important these scientists and other advisors are, because at some point they're going like, holy shit, guys, this is a really important message. And Commander Norton's like, what? It's really important. What? Really important, like this. And they're trying to deliver it takes ages for the to get from the moon to there and then through the airlock, and they get these messages spread around. It's really difficult. Yeah, you're just fiddling here.
And then Commander Norton is not in the spaceship, and yeah, he's the only one actually allowed to get the message.
Like, okay, let's bend the rules.
Like, they do some kind of like just translate it and do this stuff. Yeah. So this is also something really cool about Commander Norton. He is not only like the mainstream strict thing. He
bends the rules. Yeah, there's depth to him in that way.
His decisions are like very human.
Yeah, and even at the end, so the decisions that he makes at the end again, I don't want to give it away, but the stuff that happens at the end, you actually realize, oh, he is willing to go out there and put himself on the line, you know, and actually twist the rules if he needs to. So I want to talk about this advisory committee, because again, so many times they do this kind of thing and it's like, well, what we need to do is this. And they're all having this like really theoretical discussion, or not so much theoretical, but like, you know, very abstracted thing about it. It's like, oh, you need to do this, or you need to do this, or this might happen, or the weather might change in this way, or it's going to heat up in this way, and all that kind of stuff. And these guys are actually really important. And I think it's great that so many stories are like, well, these guys are out there by themselves. And they've got to make it through. So it's always about like one person's ingenuity, or like the hero is going to make them through, where they're going to be able to fight their way through. But in this, it's one of the few instances where there's some of the main heroes are these guys in a lab or in a conference room, or like doing computer simulations back at home. And the other story that this happens, actually, of course,
it's a political story.
No. I'm just saying that same thing happens. Another story is the movie Apollo 13. We've got it here on Blu-ray. We should watch it sometime. Yeah. Maybe we could watch that. Sometime. I was going to say, no, I'm busy tonight, so I can't watch it this time. But Apollo 13, like the real heroes, of course, they're up in space, and it's like they come in and you go, right, you've got to make this filter fit with this filter, and all you've got is this one plastic bag and this
and
little
bit
of
electrical
tape.
You see all these scientists coming together with all the stuff they have and like fiddle around and find a solution.
Yeah,
it's
and all
so
these,
fun.
And all these guys are like, they're doing that, and you realize that actually, that's the way that they're the heroes again, and this appeals to the real nerd and the technicians that, you know, among us geeky science fiction fans. It's like, yeah, even if I'm not the guy who's contacting the aliens, I could be contributing. I can help out. It's like you know, in the way of like open source software. It's like doesn't matter what happens. If I find the bug, I'll submit the bug report, and it'll be, and someone else can fix it.
The same happens on Armageddon. Like, who are the guys going out there and saving it? It's not.
Oh no, Armageddon is the opposite. Yeah, is the opposite, because in the end they do lose contact and everything does go wrong, and there is a psychopath in the crew. There's too many explosions.
You don't like some. This is something for like more people like me who's like, I have no idea about science stuff. That's way too high for me. But like in Armageddon, you are like just a worker. Like you just roll holes.
I'm sorry. It's the opposite way around. It really is the opposite way around, because Armageddon is the opposite of Rendezvous with Rama. It literally. Every single point. At every single point, it's the opposite, and it's appealing to the opposite thing. Because if a real nerd was looking at the situation, they would say, why are we training these guys to become astronauts? Why don't we train the astronauts how to drill? Because that's the easier way around to do it. And that's the way that everybody thinks when they look at it, and they just go, this only works because it's a movie. And even Michael Bay himself, because that's an example directly from, I can't remember where I read it the other day, or maybe it was on a podcast or YouTube video, and then someone said, actually during the production of Armageddon, someone asked Michael Bay, like, why are we training these guys to become astronauts instead of the other way around? And he just said, shut up, and then just moved on with making the movie. It's that little thought that goes into it. Arthur C. Clarke's the opposite. Carry on.
Thank you. I did not say that Armageddon is like Rama.
No.
What I said is that, like, for the geek and science nerds, to see that they can help out when they are not at the spot of something, they
like still the guys can, back home.
Yeah, they still can admit their help and stuff. Mm. And for, I don't count myself as a science nerd or something like that. I'm just like a normal person who has nothing to do with all these things.
Yeah, but you can't.
Let me just talk, and I just say that like in Armageddon, they put normal people to feel that they, even if they are, have nothing to do with being astronauts. They still can do something.
No, because it's fucking Bruce Willis is saving the world. It's
just, we're not talking about Armageddon.
Bruce Willis can't save the world.
Okay, our topic is running with Rama.
Okay, I'm just saying, with Armageddon, if it was really the same kind of thing, instead of sending Bruce Willis, they'd say, okay, you guys get out, and you see these nerdy guys who are back there, we'll send them up to space, because that's what actually you need to, that's what you need to, anyway, let's get away from bad movies and get back to good books. Yeah, so, that's what I'm saying, open source exploration that the people back home can do, submit bug reports, etc.
And also really, really important.
Yeah, really important. Really, I mean, they saved the day many times. They saved many lives many times. Yeah. What else have we got here?
And then there's this political side of it.
Yeah.
Like when I said there's these different ambassadors of the different colonies, like the people from
Mercury
Moon
and the
Mars. Yeah. Oh no, Mars.
What do you want to say about this? Because I don't really have much to say about that.
I know, but there's this guy from Mercury, and he's like, actually really important for that story bit.
Yeah.
No?
Yeah, the Mercury. Yeah, but I don't really have very much to say about it, because for me, I thought that was one of the weaker parts of the novel, and that only seemed to serve that they had to have a big action finale at the end of the novel,
I'm not so much talking about the action finale. So I'm more talking about that Rama actually is like, to any of the planets, Rama gets the closest to Mercury.
Yeah.
So, of course, is there something like this big coming to your planet, and you don't really know how it's going to behave? You're like you are like the bad guys.
Yeah.
No.
No, I didn't. I thought
that character is some kind of interesting character there.
Okay, so we've gotten 50 minutes already. I think if you don't have much more to say about him, we should move on to the last line, which is handily right here in Wikipedia.
Is that the spoiler?
No, not really.
I really try to avoid everything.
Look, put it this way: the next book is called Rama 2. We're not really spoiling. We're not really spoiling anything. So the great thing about this is that you go, and on far off Earth, Dr. Carlisle Pereira. Oh, that's the one they go to. Yeah. Dr. Carlisle Pereira had as yet not. Can't say it. And yet, and I'm really bad at reading out loud. And far off Earth, Dr. Carlisle Pereira had yet told no one how he had wakened from a restless sleep with a message from his subconscious still echoing in his brain. The Ramans do everything in threes, and it's true, everything is repeated three times on Rama, and that's what they discover. It's
so maybe
all like
this is
triple
why this
redundancy
is like,
yeah, so maybe it was three trenches instead of six trenches anyway. So it comes in threes, and you were like, I don't understand this last line, what's going on with this last line?
Like, it wasn't that obvious that they do three things.
Do everything in threes. Well, it was three cities, three everything. Everything was walking
on three
legs.
But they have, like, more than three cities. They have, like, London and Paris and Tokyo and New York and...
Yeah, but there's three.
And you
three
have one North Pole and you have a South Pole. You don't have, like, a...
Yeah, that's geometry. If you had a spinning triangle, it probably wouldn't.
I don't know.
A west pole? The Earth only has a North and South Pole.
I'm just... Like, this last sentence was, like, I read it as that... What? Three? Yeah, okay, maybe these biots, these robots that come up, they have...
Sure, you're giving it away. I hadn't mentioned those so far.
But, I mean... Okay.
Spoiler. Anyway, there's things called biots. Yeah, so what you're saying... There's more books in the series. That's what it comes down to. Okay. There wasn't planned to be. It says, like... the book, it says it at the Wikipedia, the book was meant to be a standalone, although the final sentence of the book suggests otherwise. Clark, however, denied that this sentence was meant to hint at a continuation of the story. According to his foreword in the book sequel, it was just a good way to end the book and was added during a final revision. So he probably just came up with that idea, threw it in the end, and you're like, oh, I mean, you can see this happening time and time again in other books. It's like, oh, we'll just end with this twist. And like, ooh,
for me, that
sequel?
Felt very constructed.
What, like contrived.
Like, okay, we have to put something on the end to make it not end.
No, I thought it was a really good ending. Yeah. I mean, I've read the other books. I think I've read the other. Anyway, so all I want to say is don't bother reading the other books because, like, I can't remember. There's like some more in this. There's Rondo of Rama, then Rama 2, then the Garden of Rama and Rama Revealed. I've mentioned this many times before, Rama Revealed. What they actually do is reveal the whole purpose of Rama and where it was going and where it was coming from and all of this kind of stuff.
When did Arthur C. Clarke die?
Like, he is dead. 2009 or something? Let me have a look. 2008, March 2008.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, anyway, so these other books are written not by just Arthur C. Clarke. They're actually written by... also Gentry Lee, and I've never read a non-Arthur C. Clarke Gentry Lee I've never read a book which wasn't a collaboration by Gentry Lee. Let me actually look here at his he's also old and bald. No, I can't really he doesn't even have a list of books here as well. He's pretty much best known for Rama 2 with Arthur C. Clarke, and there are some things in those books which are interesting to read, but like I see, you get to the reveal and you're like, it was much better when it was mysterious. It was much better when, like, the whole point about it is that there's still more discoveries to be made. Science isn't completed. There's always more out there to discover. And so often when they're, like, again, going back to Promethean, it's like, and now these are the answers. And we literally see the birth of life on Earth, and you get to it and you're just like, that's really shit. It was way better when you just didn't know where the aliens came from and the Nevian and all that kind of stuff. So time and time again, you if you keep going and provide all the answers, it does weaken the mystery. But you don't know all the answers, so I would say don't bother reading on in this series.
Like, this book is good. I don't really have the feeling I should read more.
Yeah, I just do want to do at the end of this podcast is actually talk a little bit now about the end. Just to talk about the biography of Arthur C. Clarke, and if you see a book with somebody else's name on it, like for example, here it says, Beyond the Fall of Night with Gregory Benford. Don't read that one. Richter 10 with Mike McKay. Probably one of the worst science fiction books I've read. Really, don't read that one. The Trigger is good for the first third. What's that with Michael P. Kubi McDowell? And then that's about good for the first. And then The Light of Other Days starts off as like a really good like novella, short story kind of thing, and then goes a long way down. I've never actually read The Last Theorem, because by then, as you see, all of these final books of Arthur C. Clarke, it's with this person, with that person. Actually, 3001, The Final Odyssey, that's pretty good. But after that, it just goes downhill.
Just by himself,
yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's good, because it's by himself. So I'd say stay away from these books. If you're gonna do Arthur C. Clarke, do City in the Stars. Certainly the first half is absolutely amazing. Childhood's End, I was never a big fan of that. 2001 Space Odyssey, Rendezvous Rama, Fountains in Paradise, and yeah, Odyssey 2 and Odyssey 3, and those keep going on. But yeah, loads of really, really great short stories too. Anyway, I think that's all we've got to say. Are we going to rate this book now, Juliana?
Yeah, you wanted me to help finding my rating.
No, you wanted me to help you find your rating.
Okay, which is for me is the same. But yeah, let's talk about it. So I really enjoyed the characters. I enjoyed the whole mission of it. I did not really get the description of Rama, which made everything super like clunky in my head, and was like, wait,
I'm really surprised about that, because like that's what makes this book so good. Maybe it's just the German translation, or maybe things just aren't clear, or maybe you have like one idea in your head and that was there too early, you know, and it didn't get kicked out very clearly.
But for me, the description is so difficult to just put in my head and like in a good order, and like I do have a idea how it looks from the outside, but the inside was totally like, oh, okay, there's some
most of
water.
The action happens on the inside. So what are you gonna give it, 1 star, 5 stars, or somewhere in between?
Yeah, I don't know, 4 or 3.
You can go 3.5.
Yeah, maybe 3.
This,
and a half.
For me, I know it's weird to say this, for me, this would easily be a 4-star book, because I think there's a lot to like in this. The audiobook narration really brought it down a lot, because it was just so bad.
In
so
many,
no, I was keep that sentence wasn't over. I was just pausing randomly at that point, because then I'll continue on a bit later when I get to the, it's like literally, did he get to the end of it, like the sentence, maybe he was reading it from a page and he just got to the end of the line and he was taking time to get back to the previous line before he carried on with the next line. Yeah, it's just really bad. I made a note of the audiobook narrators here. Peter Gammon, his name was. Who listened to him do that first chapter and go, yeah, this is going to be great. Rendezvous Rama, one of the you know classics of 20th century science fiction. Let's get like someone who just can't read. Like it would have been okay. Maybe someone needs to go through and like put a filter on. It's like anytime there's a pause, take the pause out. You know, that kind of filter that you can put on audio. No, you can do that. You can filter that. Look for blank space and fill it in. But sometimes you need the pause and sometimes you don't. And it's just a massive complaint. So that took off. That certainly knocked off a half a point. Anything else you want to say? Otherwise, we should wrap this up because we've done an hour on this topic now.
3.5 stars for me.
Okay, I'll say 3.5 stars. So we'll average them out to 3.5 stars. What book are we going to do next together?
I'm currently reading Metro 2033,
which is a Russian book translated.
A Russian novel. Novel.
Yeah. Any good?
We can, like, maybe you read it. You had it on your to-do list. I would say, personally, I think it's not science fiction. Maybe the science fiction will come, but only because...
But it's post-apocalyptic in the...
Yeah, but only because you had a nuclear fallout.
Well, that's enough to be science fiction, because now it's set in the future and it's speculative.
But actually, the story is, like, so, like, they fall back in time and they have nothing, so it's, like, not even... No science going on. No,
really great. Let's read The Chrysalids next. Chrysalids by John Winnett. He did Day of the Triffids. Yeah. We'll do The Chrysalids at some point too as well. Okay, my next book is called Barrier by Lewis McMaster Bejold, and it's really good. I'm going to see if I can get Juliana to read those. If you read those books, and then we can continue on with the story, the series, maybe we can continue together and maybe in the future, because it's going to be very difficult to go through these and do this series without spoilers of previous books and all that kind of stuff. So maybe if we just do it more as a book club thing, like we can just discuss and other people can read along with the series as well if they want. Maybe we could do that kind of thing and do a few episodes on that series. Maybe. Otherwise, yeah, you can email me, luke@juggler.net, if you've got any suggestions, book suggestions, or anything that you want to do, any feedback. If you've got a novel that you want me to read, how about you don't send me an email about it? That would be also really cool. You can follow me on goodreads.com, and also you can follow Juliana Kunzendorf on goodreads.com. You can see what she's reading at any point and her little reviews that she puts up, their little updates or whatever you do. Do you ever put updates on there? Or you just list books that you finished reading?
I do put updates, but I never write stuff.
Okay. And what else? Yeah, you can check out sfbrp.com and check out the episodes. The list of episodes there is really handy to look through. And yes, and also Twitter. I'm at Luke Burge on Twitter. My blog is at lukeburge.com/blog. Oh my god, loads of this stuff just keeps going. Oh, if you want to read any of my novels, you can read them. Oh, that's what we're going to do. We're going to do a review of Minding Tomorrow and spoilerific. We'll do a full spoilerific of review of my series.
There was one person on Goodreads called Tudor.
Tudor?
Yeah, he sent me a very nice recommendation of a book. I might check that out.
And what's the book? Click on it.
Song for Arbonne. Click on it so we can...
A Song for Arbonne.
It sounds more like a historic...
Yeah, by Guy Gavriel Kay. Yeah, Guy Gavriel Kay has been recommended to me a number of times as well in the past. So maybe it's just fantasy. There's different series that goes on there. Anyway, I think that's it for me. Say goodbye, Juliana.
Goodbye, listeners.
And I'll catch you next time.